Welcome to Upthinking Finance, a podcast that offers a unique and discerning view of economics and financial planning. Here is your host, Emerson Fersh.
Welcome back to another edition of Upthinking Finance. I'm Emerson Fersh. Jim Grant, publisher of Jim Grant's Interest Rate Observer, once said, "Progress is cumulative in science and engineering, but cyclical in finance." And if there was ever an industry where history repeats itself, finance would certainly be at the top of the list. I'm excited today for the interview and the discussion. I'm inviting back a return guest. His name is Professor Russell Napier. He's the author of the Solid Ground Investment Report for Institutional Investors and co-founder of the investment research portal ERIC, a business he now co-owns with DC Thompson. Russell has worked in the investment business for over 30 years and has been advising global institutional investors on asset allocation since 1995. He's written a couple of exceptional books. The first is called The Anatomy of the Bear, Lessons from Wall Street's Four Great Bottoms, and more recently, published in 2021, The Asian Financial Crisis from 1995 to 1998, Birth of the Age of Debt. He's the founder and course director for the Practical History of Financial Markets, which is an online course available at the Edinburgh Business School, a course which I've taken and I have to say is exceptional, very thorough. And in 2014, Russell founded the charitable venture, The Library of Mistakes, which is a business and financial history library in Edinburgh, Scotland, that also now has branches in India and Switzerland. And The Library of Mistakes is the subject of my interview with Professor Napier today. So it's my pleasure to welcome back to Upthinking Finance, coming to us from Edinburgh, Scotland, the keeper of the Library of Mistakes, Professor Russell Napier. Russell, welcome back.
Emerson, it is great to be back.
Thank you. So let's start off with, in your words, what exactly is the Library of Mistakes?
Well, the Library of Mistakes is actually, at its core, it's a business and financial history library. But as I like to say, if we called it the Edinburgh Business and Financial History Library, nobody would come. So it has a more lurid name. And mistakes, of course, are part of business and financial history. They're not all of it. They're a subset. But the subset that we get a lot of focus on. Frankly, if you write a book about a mistake or a calamity, you're likely to sell more copies. Maybe even than if you write about a success. So it's just the nature of financial history that that is the case. But I think there's an important point here. I don't know how many books we have in the Library of Mistakes about Warren Buffett. Now, Warren Buffett is not a mistake. He's a success. There are perhaps hundreds of books about Warren Buffett, but how many of us can be Warren Buffett? It may actually be easier to learn from the mistakes, to learn what not to do, rather than to learn what to do. I met a man called Peter Berwash, who was a very successful tennis player. And he said the secret of amateur tennis was to get the ball over the net and allow somebody else to make the mistake. So it is business and financial history, but we end up looking at mistakes because it just may be easier to learn from mistakes than to learn from successes. I mean, how many Steve Jobs are really going to walk into a library and work out that how to be Steve Jobs? So that's why the focus has kind of shifted a little bit on the Library of Mistakes, but it's a broader scope than that.
And so, I mean, what was the brainstorm? I know we talked before and you mentioned, I think, referred to yourself as a bit of a historian. I mean, what was sort of the inspiration to even to start this? Because it's, what, about 10 years now? Is that right?
The library's been going for 10 years. There's a course associated with the same charity, which has now been going for just over 20 years. And this is really relates to my own learning experience in financial markets, because I came to financial markets as a lawyer with no back in finance, economics, or accounting. I then sat these exams and started passing the exams that you have to take. But I didn't think that they told me very much about what I was witnessing every day on the screen or in investing. And I found personally that a reading of financial history was the quickest way to get up that learning curve. So I've always personally had an interest. Now, that was started a long time ago, back in 1989. So by 2004, we launched the Practical History of Financial Markets course. 10 years after that, one of the great replies I used to get from when I recommended people to read financial history said, well, where can we find it? Because universities in particular had stripped out a lot of economics and finance history textbooks. So we then concluded that the next obvious step for the charity was to open a library. So it's kind of organic. It's been growing. And all the time, the focus is what modern current investors can learn from financial history.
Now, was this just your idea or is this something that you had a partner with? I mean, I'm just kind of wondering if this literally you started it yourself from the ground up.
I have to plead guilty to starting this, but obviously guilty to starting it. But obviously, there's been a lot of contributions over the years and financial contributions over the years. So
I was going to say there's no lack of material, is there? Oh, I meant subject matter. Sorry, you're talking about support.
Well, I'm talking both. So obviously the thing can just grow and grow from a volume perspective.
Sure.
But also we've had support from others and provided financial support for it as well, which is why we are. The course also provides revenue. It's sold and it provides revenue to support the library. So my idea, but you know, support comes from everywhere. We now have one in India and Lausanne. I think I probably shouldn't mention the others that now seem likely because we haven't signed on the dotted line yet, but it looks likely that we'll have two others within the next 2 years.
I hate to ask, but just because you may not be able to say, but is the US on that list anywhere or not yet?
Well, the US isn't on the two. If I tell you there's someone in the Rocky Mountains who's very keen to open one on his retirement, I think I'd just leave it there. I think it's interesting that it would be the Rocky Mountains and not Manhattan that might have the first library of mistakes. I have been to do a pitch to an institution in Manhattan, and I won't mention its name either, but I was told after a 45-minute pitch that this is Manhattan. We don't do mistakes. Well, in my opinion, Manhattan is one of the biggest net exporters of mistakes on the planet. But anyway, in the eyes of the Manhattanites, they don't do mistakes.
I was just going to say, they're doing their job supplying constant new material. And yeah, no, that's funny. I had a chance for anybody, you know, who's interested, because obviously I hope to get out to Scotland and see from what I've seen online, it's beautiful. But you can access, I mean, that catalog is amazing that you have set up there. I mean, I actually found a book I shared with you offline after our first interview. My financial roots go back to the Lincoln Savings American Continental Charles Keating Savings Alone era, and went online and found a really good book I was not aware that was written called Trust Me. It was actually very enlightening. In fact, I could go on and on about that, but clearly you've got just a huge amount of resources.
Yeah. What can I say about our resources? They really go back into the 17th century. So this has been going on for a long time. I mean, we kind of start when securities market starts and liquidity in securities markets begins in the 17th century. But I think most of your listeners won't be aware that Scotland, of course, owes its constitution to one of the greatest mistakes in financial history, which is in the late, about 1696, it decided that it would create its own colony in Darien, which not the one near New York, but the one in the Isthmus of Panama. I won't go through the details of that, but it basically bankrupted the country and forced it to sue for an alliance with England and forming the United Kingdom. So if you like, our entire country was formed on a mistake. So it's a good place. Edinburgh is quite a good place to have a library of mistakes. That mistake is still debated today. You probably know it's contentious, as is the issue of the union. But without the mistake, one wonders whether it would have happened or maybe it just would have been delayed by a few decades.
Well, I tell you, it's actually exciting, and I'm glad that our firm's been able to have a little bit of a part. You know, that's kind of the fun part about the technology world now, is a guy here in a small little financial firm here in the southwest part of the U.S. can get involved with the work you're doing over the other side of the Atlantic. It's fun.
Your involvement is really appreciated. And anybody listening to this can go to our website, librarymistakes.com, watch live. Maybe the time difference is a bit of a challenge, but these lectures are all recorded. And there's also a podcast where I do interview people about financial history. So we are creating quite a bit of content, which is all free. And it's all based on this thesis that we can learn something about the future from a better understanding of the past.
No, and that's actually a good point. Then I want to jump into the awards ceremony from last week because that was awesome. But there's a lot of resources on there, a lot of good information, and your interviews are exceptional. I can't remember the gentleman's name, talking about the bond market. You had that portfolio manager that was talking about his mistakes. I mean, it's actually a really good point that it's kind of like my theory has always been, when the markets are going up, you know, everything's making money, but you really learn about investments and things, what happens when stuff goes sideways. And so it's sort of the same idea. So let's talk about the Mistake of the Year Awards. This was great. It's online for anybody, and the link will appear on our during while we're having this conversation. It was an education. I can't say I'm surprised at the amount of material you had to sift through to decide who the winner was, which I guess is kind of a sad state to commentary. It certainly was a broad array of different situations, I think. And I got to just, there's a few what I'm going to call honorable mentions that came up in the beginning. You mentioned wealth managers that remain invested in bonds, which is, you know, that's a good one. But Ben Bernanke, I'm guessing there's some kind of an inside joke there that I'm thinking I should know, but I just couldn't quite connect the dots on that one.
It's more of an inside joke to me, actually, and central bankers are not loved by economists. I'm not actually an economist myself, but I move in the circles of economists. So when you say, give me a nomination for Mistake of the Year, they all rush to mention Ben Bernanke. I think, of course, they would be equally scathing about Greenspan, and not quite so bad about the current incumbent. Yeah, there is a bit of a standing joke. I suspect there's one individual who will nominate Ben Bernanke every year. He may well be watching this, Emerson. He knows who he is.
So, okay, is this because Ben Bernanke is the author of The Gift, The Mistake That Keeps on Giving?
Yeah,
Okay.
He launched quantitative easing. I think most of us conceded that was necessary at the time to prevent the contraction in broad money and liquidity and prevent the debt deflation. But the continuation and the continuation and the continuation of it was, that baton was passed onwards. I think most people realize that it's caused huge distortions to asset markets, huge distortions to wealth distribution, and ultimately social problems, which may come back to haunt us. So it's really interesting because Bernanke is a financial historian. He's an expert on the Great Deflation. He acted initially, and in my opinion, rightly, to prevent what turned into a great social rupture in America and the world. But ironically, he may have created a different form of social dislocation through that intervention, which may play out differently. It'd be easy to say it's too early to tell you, but I think we're seeing some of the social political consequences of that impact on wealth distribution. So, the medicine was definitely better initially than the disease, but the medicine itself comes with consequences. That's something we find out quite a lot when we look at mistakes. That disease is one thing, but the cure gives you these unintended consequences, which can be just as bad and occasionally even worse.
Mm. Okay, well, I'm glad I figured that one out. So you mentioned, and there's just a couple here I wanted to bring up before we get into the final three, but you, this HOMRI, if I'm pronouncing that right, it's, I guess, an organization that was set up to help provide housing for the homeless over in Europe. And from what I recall, sounds like it lasted about 2.5 years, and that was the end of it. Again, and this is for the education of listeners to see, just be able to identify how different things can blow up. What happened there, if you can explain that?
Well, HOMRI is back in the news today. Actually, it's now being investigated by the authorities here. So it's beyond a commercial thing, and it's being looked at from a regulatory perspective to look at any wrongdoing. It raised in three tranches, 760 million sterling. And it raised it, I think the last tranche was raised as recently as 2022, and it was suspended in 2023. So one of the reasons it focuses is just how incredibly quickly this whole thing happened. In the second half of 2023, its assets, the valuation of its assets were reduced by 58%. Once again, that's not unheard of for these things to happen, but the sheer pace of it was quite dramatic. Now, there are legal suits on this one. So last week, I just read out the statement of the lawyers who are now working for the shareholders against the advisors to the board and the board. And it, basically, the allegation is that the board wasn't aware of the condition of the properties, the legal liabilities and the legal duties around these properties, the ability of the tenants to pay rent. And that money was spent very rapidly and very rapidly fell in value. And that's the story of HOMRI. I mean, the allegations by the lawyers, and I stress it's by the lawyers because I'm not privy to what's been going on specifically inside HOMRI, is that the board really didn't understand the business they were in and therefore allocated the capital incredibly badly in a very short period of time, about 18 months, which had the share price suspended, and it remains suspended. It was suspended last January 23, and it's still suspended. So this one will play out in the courts, but it's a kind of a story of how quickly money can be lost. If the lawyers are right and the board really didn't know what sort of business it was in and didn't really understand of the risk that the business it was in.
Hmm. You also mentioned something I wanted to ask if you can elaborate on to the extent you can, because I think it has. You talked about European governments backing pensions. And I think there's also that, I think, has an application to a lot of the bigger pensions here in the U.S. I mean, I've got a lot of clients in California that have CalPERS and even STIRS, which is a teacher's pension, and there's a number of big ones like that. Just curious, the reason why that got a nod.
Well, this one in the United Kingdom is different from the one you've mentioned, because at least you've got some assets to back yours.
Okay.
Which is not the situation we find ourselves in the United Kingdom. So we have 5 million public sector workers here in the UK who will qualify for these pensions. They are inflation protected, and they are defined benefit. Now, that's the sort of pension that most people can only dream of. Defined benefit inflation link. And there are some schemes that are funded well enough that can provide that and are currently providing that. And that's wonderful. But the main problem with the UK one is it's largely almost totally unfunded. And it will be future taxpayers who make up the payments to these public workers and their large inflation-linked defined benefit pension schemes. And no matter how you work that out, we have, as you can probably guess from the nomination, we have someone at the Library of Mistakes who's an actuary who works this out. I mean, his numbers are that that's a 1.4 trillion liability on the government of the United Kingdom, which is going to come due at some course. But because, as you know, the history of mistakes, a history of politics, a history of all decision-making is if you can avoid making the difficult decision today, try and push it down the road. So history's littered with these where we just pretend it doesn't exist until the day it comes to exist. So it's obviously going to be a problem. But because nobody's prepared to say when it's a problem and no one's prepared to do anything about it, I suspect it'll be nominated next year and the year after. and many years to come, we'll realize it's just not sustainable. It can't be funded. How the government then welshes on those obligations, that's a political decision. It's not an economic decision. It's a political decision, but that will have to come in due course.
That almost, okay, so I'm giving the wrong comparison. That almost sounds more like Social Security here.
that's really what it is.
Yeah.
The form it takes because of the lack of funding for it. So we could spend a lot of time talking about mistakes and this wealth distribution and the inequalities between the old and the young. Well, this is another one for the young to worry about, that, you know, as time goes on, a lot of their tax dollars or tax pounds will be going to pay the pensions of the old people who they so dislike. Yeah. That's going to go down well, isn't it? I mean, the baby boomers living high off the hog on the tax paid by the younger generation is something that's really going to be a huge political issue at some stage.
Well, kind of ironic. And then I have to bring this one up only because Farfetch. And I laugh because I literally ordered a hoodie that came from Japan probably 3 weeks ago. So that was one I knew. If I remember right, there's some kind of at least they began as some kind of a distribution channel for luxury goods or something like that, kind of a hub. Is that right? Maybe just share that one. I'm kind of selfishly asking because it's one I'm actually pretty familiar with, at least from having used them once.
Well, the scale of the damage may be worth talking about for investors anyway. I mean, this thing had a market capitalization at one stage of $26 billion. At the suspended share price, it's worth $8 million. Now, once again, the lawyers will sort out exactly what's going to go on with the assets of the company and the liabilities of the company, and the creditors are suing. But Farfetch began life as an e-commerce site, and it sought to match up buyers with luxury branded goods selling companies. Now, the bigger ones of those were not that keen to get involved because obviously they had their own websites, they had their own bricks and mortar, they had their own distribution channels. So it kind of struggled with lots of smaller ones. I mean, it was a business that had lots of customers and lots of sales. It didn't have lots of profits, of course, as is the way with lots of e-commerce sites. But somewhere along the line, it decided that because of this problem with getting the right type, if you like, of luxury branded products, they would get into the business of buying those companies. So they came to the stock market, raised a lot of capital, from memory about $850 million, and then went on an acquisition spree. It's a bit like owning a supermarket, not having the right things to sell. So going out and buying Kellogg's so that you show you something to sell in your supermarket. So it was a major diversification. These are companies that are difficult to value. They were all trading on high valuations anyway. We had a huge boom going on in luxury branded products, partially due to Chinese demand. The lawyers will tell, history will tell, just how overvalued these acquisitions were. But from setting up to do one business, it was suddenly in another business. And the consequence, as I mentioned, is that the market capitalization went from $26 billion to $8
million. Wow. So the common thread, at least between a couple of these you've mentioned, well, I mean, you could even say the pension situation too, is people in positions not understanding really what they're getting into. I mean, you talk about buying these businesses to increase your distribution. I mean, what does an e-commerce site know about running a clothing company or whatever the luxury item? I mean, that's kind of at least a common thread here, right?
Yeah, well, you find standard themes and mistakes. I mean, we could classify them. No doubt as the awards go on year to year to year, we'll begin to classify these into categories. And that one is diversification, or I think it's Warren Buffett who calls it diversification. That will crop up over and over and over again. Look, we mentioned Farfetch, but it's very, very common for boards to get into that. I mean, we could sit and run off a whole ream of boards that have got into that. I mean, they feel compelled to do it because the original business is struggling, usually. They convince themselves then that there's a synergy between the two, which is usually not there, but you can convince yourself of anything if you need something to perk up your share price. And then the rest is history. I mean, we just ply on and it happens again and again and again. So it really should be up to the board to rein in chief executives on that. I think that would be my opinion anyway. But often the board get caught up in the hysteria because who doesn't want to be involved in a company that is growing, doing acquisitions and getting onto the front page of the newspapers? So I think the board sometimes gets caught up in the hysteria. And of course, they've got lots of investment bankers, Emerson, telling them that it's a wonderful idea. We mustn't forget that as well.
Yeah, I'm sure. The fees for that kind of work, I imagine, are pretty good too. There's a lot of wisdom what you just said. Yeah, I could see we could go on for hours talking about this stuff, which is, I could get why you had to start a whole library to try to contain it all. Okay, so then you guys got to the top three, and Credit Suisse was number three, the sweepstakes here. And The main thing I had that I just wrote a couple notes down I wanted to bring up, I mean, the bank itself or the firm itself had been around for pushing, well, I won't say 200 years, but 1856, survived the great financial crisis, which you'd think that would be enough. But what happened there? For me, again, and that kind of came out of left field, but that doesn't mean that you would also mention, I think, at the ceremony that the seeds had been kind of brewing for a while, if I'm remembering that right.
Yeah, when we look back in the last 30, 40 years of history, we will see, and we've already seen, there are lots of banks and bankers who were just not contented in being a local bank. Let's call it a retail bank, maybe even a retail bank with a corporate arm. The basic dynamic was get big or get eaten. Speaking to you from Scotland, the home of Royal Bank of Scotland and Bank of Scotland, that I think they were very clearly in the category where they wanted to get big enough so that they couldn't be taken over. So it wasn't a uniquely Swiss affliction, this desire to grow. But the Swiss did want to play with the very biggest of boys in the room. Back in the 1980s, they acquired First Boston, which is a prime, you know, a very good US broker. So they were instantly putting money on the line to play in the most competitive market of all, which is the US capital market. But they followed that up with a stream of acquisitions of service companies. And with the benefit of hindsight, they probably overpaid for all of them. But I think, I mean, the lesson I flagged up at the award ceremony is paying very high valuations for service companies, where all of the assets go up and down in the lift. Basically, all of the assets go up and down in the lift. They are the individuals. I mean, even Warren Buffett, when he was briefly involved with Salomon Brothers, really struggled to make money in a business where the assets behave like football players rather than employees. So we had acquisition after acquisition after acquisition. In the last several years, that began to catch up with the bank. It eventually led to an outflow of funds. Interestingly, for Credit Suisse, there were two sources of funds there. I mean, obviously it has depositors like any other bank, but it had a really big wealth management business as well. And quite a lot of the value in the shares was associated with the size of the assets under management from the wealth management business. But those funds began to leave as well. The departure of those funds doesn't in any way threaten the solvency of a major bank, unlike the departure of deposits. But it did threaten the valuation of the bank. And so we had a capital infusion by one of its major shareholders from Saudi Arabia. But what really finished it off was that same shareholder saying just a few weeks later that there would be no more capital. And the runs in both sides of that business got bigger and bigger. It's a thing that had been seen coming for many, many years. I'm not sure anybody could have forecast which year it was going to happen in. But it just seemed more likely as the years went by. As I flagged up in the awards ceremony, one of the key things about this was the scale of the intervention that had to be put in place to make sure this bank moved smoothly into new ownership. And new ownership in this case is UBS. The package wasn't ultimately all used. But if you put together the package from the government, the package from the central bank, I think it was over a third of Swiss GDP was up as a potential size of intervention that was needed. This is the second biggest bank in Switzerland. You know, your Silicon Valley Bank, which we will come back to, was the 16th biggest bank in America. These guys lost their second biggest bank really in a weekend. After a long, long period when everybody wondered, could it survive? Suddenly it disappeared in a weekend, which is maybe another part of the story, is just how quickly things can get moving when confidence is lost. It's always been a problem for bankers, but things have speeded up a little bit in terms of the loss of confidence. And that's Credit Suisse. And that's why we put it in there. I think it's because, and this is a remarkable thing, there were so many mistakes last year that it's almost like we didn't notice that one of the biggest banks in the world just disappeared.
That, so you just brought up an interesting point, and tell me if I'm getting this right. It sounds like some of these decisions that were made 30 to 40 years ago, I mean, that's like a slow, long, but I mean, that's just, I mean, how do you even anticipate that? Because then my thought goes to Russell, it goes to, okay, we know like the AIGs, we know all the bailouts that happened here in 08, 09, but are there still lingering consequences from that that are building and ready to bubble up at some point in the next 4 or 5 years? I mean, you know what I'm saying? It seems like, boy, that's really hard to predict. I mean, how does anybody even really, you know, you mentioned hindsight and valuations of some of the acquisitions. I mean, how do you see that in real time? Is there a way to even identify it?
Well, I think the first thing is banks are different. So banks have to be geared. It's the nature of the business to borrow short and lend long. They take our deposits and they lend long. And if you run any business with gearing, you're more susceptible to the consequences from mistake. And those mistakes can cost you your solvency. That's the first thing to say. These things are more important for banks, for the rest of us. Naming the timing for Credit Suisse, I don't think it could have been done. I know many people who've been pointing it out for years, but cannot mention their names. There are other major European banks where people have been saying for years that they could follow the path that Credit Suisse has just followed, that they've got into the international markets They've overpaid for assets. They haven't succeeded in those businesses. And I just don't think it was possible to know when it was going to happen. You know, the thing that finished it off was a couple of announcements. They announced that their report and accounts had material weaknesses. Never a good sign when you announce material weaknesses to your report and accounts. If one of your shareholders jumps up in public and says, we're not providing any more support, this is not a wise thing for any shareholder to do, I think. So I do think it was very difficult. But yes, there are lingering problems from the GFC and before in that a lot of the assets, I mean, if you look at the price-to-book ratio of European banks, for instance, they're trading at deep, deep discounts to their assets. Well, many of those banks also did acquisitions of other businesses prior to the GFC at you know, great premiums to book value. So that is that there's a lingering problem for many of these banks. And as I said, only modesty and the lawyers prevent me from mentioning who they are.
Well, no, that's helpful and a little concerning, but such is the world we live in. The next one was this FTX. I mentioned before we started, I'm still not clear on exactly what happened here. One of the things I remember that came up when you brought them up at the ceremony, I'm calling it, was that the CEO was raising money while he was playing video games, which just inherently sounds like a problem. But maybe if to the extent you can, again, I think it'd be really helpful to bring that down a few notches so people really get it. I mean, everybody's familiar. We saw pictures of the CEO and that young 20-year-old, I mean, that his treasurer or CFO or whatever. I mean, I think these two are in charge of all this money. That's a whole nother topic. I shouldn't probably even go there. But anyway, FTX.
That's the thing we have to flag up, because FTX raised $2 billion from investors. And they raised it from the smartest guys in the room, or people we like to think are the smartest guys in the room, which are kind of venture capital, private equity. And the problem was that there was then no control over that investment, which is absolutely stunning when you think of it, given the age. I mean, young people can be very smart, very innovative, very creative. Mark Zuckerberg was very young when he created what turned out to be a huge company. There's nothing wrong with that. And there may be nothing wrong in taking the sort of risks that the venture capitalists took. But to have nobody on the board, to have no internal control, to rely upon, let's call them the geniuses, maybe they were geniuses, the geniuses in the company with no control, seems just to be incredible. Everybody who invested in the company was getting fees. They were getting paid for their expertise in this. But it's something that's come up again and again, particularly with a company called Wirecard and Greensill. Major investments from major VCs, major private equity investments, and yet the level of oversight, which was really pretty terrible. So without that oversight, something was probably going to happen. And something did happen, and it was confusing two different businesses, really. It was the CEO who was funding one business with money that people were treating really as a form of deposit in one business, arguably whether crypto is a form of deposit, but arguably taking a form of deposit and using it to fund a different business without the knowledge of people who were putting money into the deposit, taking risks with the so-called deposit that people didn't fully understand. That's not a new problem at all. I mean, all over the world, lawyers are often found dipping their fingers into the client account, for instance, end up in court themselves. Better Call Saul might be a pretty good example of that for those who watch it. You know, this is not a new problem that funds over here are misused over here. The issue was that why on earth did these investors not have some form of control to monitor this, control this, and ultimately prevent it? So that's why they were nominated for the mistake. That's the first reason they were nominated for mistake. But the truth is, though, in FTX, there's a myriad of mistakes that we could focus on. Of course, FTX did get a criminal conviction. I think he's on appeal, but he has at this stage, Sam Bankman-Fried, I should say, has a criminal conviction, and which is on appeal, I think.
You explained too, as I remember, that there was an element of sort of a, I don't know what the word is, some kind of a code of warped. Well, I remember you guys talked about CEOs being four times as likely to be a psychopath. There was a study that was, which, you know, again, we could go off on tangents here with this stuff. But there was some kind of code of a willingness to, by the CEO, to just take whatever risks for some kind of his perception of the greater good. And if the whole thing blew up, then no harm, no foul. I mean, am I?
Yeah, well, I think the best way to put that is the testimony of Caroline Ellison, who was his one-time girlfriend and also involved in the company. And she said on their oath that if Bankman-Fried could toss a coin, and the consequence of tossing the coin is that everybody in the world would die if you got a head. But if you got a tail, everybody in the world would be twice as well off. He would flip the coin. Now, most of us wouldn't flip the coin, but he would flip the coin. Now, he and I think it's not fair to call it purely utilitarianism, but that is what he thought this was, utilitarianism, which is a form of philosophical argument that goes back to John Stuart Mill and Jeremy Bentham in the middle of the 19th century. But he argued that this was correct. And I think we see a lot of that in business. I think Theranos may be another good example. She also testified that he didn't really care whether he told the truth or not, because the only thing that really mattered was the greater good for everyone, at least as he conceived it and under risks that he imposed upon them. Yeah, so I think that is something that pervades the corporate world. Now, the corporation is a very powerful part of our society, very important part of our society, and does an awful lot of good in society as well, and generates the products that we all choose to buy from it. But there is also within it a form of decision making, which is maybe not very, it's very hard to reconcile with the morals of the society as a whole. I'm not saying, by no means am I saying that everybody who runs a corporation is like Sam Bankman-Fried. Just saying that there are some people within it. And the test that you mentioned, or the survey that you mentioned, is from a book called The Psychopath Test by John Ronson, where he thinks he proves that psychopaths are four times more likely to run listed companies. Well, that's a problem for all of us, for society. If we have created an incentive structure that over-rewards psychopaths, I think we need to reconsider the incentive structure.
Yeah. That's a good place to start. I was thinking about this because the first thing you said about the smartest guys in the room giving people like this all this money, and it's almost like there used to be a term, I don't know if it's still relevant, called blind pool. I remember some of these big firms, you know, they'd have this, basically you give them their money and you wouldn't know what it was going to do or where it was going to go. But it kind of reminds me, you know, because you have the tenure in this industry and this work, but it's like 98, 99. That kind of strikes me as that same, just throw any money at anything that has a .com after it. I mean, there's a sloppiness, I wouldn't even call it greed, that just, again, I guess it's like the history repeating itself in some certain different kind of ways, but that just strikes me as sort of along the same ilk.
Yeah, so there's two different issues. You can sort of spray the money around as, take a basket and hope that. The thing is that one of these things can shoot the lights out by such a huge number that it can compensate for five or six duds. But that's not the reason that we had FTX nominated, was that if you are going to give somebody money, at least have the good grace, if you're calling, if you are claiming a fee for doing this, to put some monitoring in place. So I'm not particularly a kind of fan of let's just spray the money around and see if we get one winner. But if I was in that business, I would at least have somebody on the board.
Yeah, for appearances.
That is the mistake, I think. You know, venture capitalists, they're going to find a lot of duds. Of course, they're going to find a lot of duds. But that wasn't the problem in FTX. The problem was that they gave $2 billion and didn't have any oversight really in how it was using. There was an advisory board, but the advisory board didn't have any real control over what was going on in the company. So it's a different, this is not a criticism of venture capital, it's just a criticism of this particular approach to it, where you have no oversight or no control once the money is handed over.
No, that's good. All right, you already mentioned the name, but I'll let you announce the winner for anybody who hasn't seen the event yet. And let's talk a little bit about them.
Well, it is your own. Have we got outside? Yeah, I think we're mainly on American corporations so far. Farfetch, I think, was technically Portuguese, though maybe listed in America or listed in the UK. But yes, it is your very own Silicon Valley Bank, the 16th largest bank in the United States of America. And now we have it nominated because we think it found a new way to bankrupt a bank, which is quite an achievement given that banks have been around since the 17th century and they're failing all the time. I mean, they're literally failing all the time. You have a lot of banks in America. If you look at the FDI statistics, it's very rare to find a quarter where you don't have a bank failing. Sometimes they just get wound up. They don't fail and cost anybody any money. They found a new way to do this. And that is, they found the best credit in the world, or what is certainly one of the best credits in the world. It's called the United States government. And they managed to, I have to choose the word bankrupt carefully, because they're not bankrupt. They ended up in the arms of a rescuer. But they managed to find themselves needing rescued, is probably the best way of putting it, by lending money to the best credit in the world, which is the United States government, one of the best credits in the world. So that's quite an achievement. And for a banker, I'm not sure that that's happened before. I think there's been some investors who may have got themselves wrong way around in that before. I'm thinking of Orange County and Robert Citron, perhaps back in the early 1990s. But that was a pension fund. That was what was supposed to be an ungeared institution. But these guys managed to do it on government bonds. First of all, you don't have to take that risk at all. You could be at the short end of the government bond and not take huge capital risk. But they seem to be at the long end of the curve and take that risk and not hedge it in any way. By Christmas of 2022, I think the loss on government bonds was $15 billion. Which was enough to frighten the horses, as we say here in the UK, which is the second mistake, which maybe we should come back to. But they had a lot of very large horses owning deposits there. It wasn't, the depositors of Silicon Valley Bank were not mom and pops. They were not widely spread. They were not guaranteed. 85% of their deposit base wasn't guaranteed because the size of the deposits was so big. So it didn't take a lot to get that stampede underway. So they had two mistakes at the same time.
Okay. So to explain for anybody who doesn't understand, their portfolio was primarily just what, long-term government bonds?
They had a very big balance sheet, but they had a significant portion in government debt. It turns out quite a lot of that was further out the yield curve. The problem with that is, where the further out you go the yield curve, the more risk to capital you have. You usually get rewarded with a higher yield if you go out there. It's quite tempting if you take deposits at a low rate to get out that yield curve and make a profit. But you are taking a capital risk. If I lend you money, Emerson, I'm also taking a capital risk, obviously, because you may not pay me back. But as interest rates go up, it'll take us some time to establish whether you're not going to pay me back or not. But these bonds of the American government, they reset minute to minute. And the losses associated with that can come through very, very, very quickly. And that's what happened in this particular scenario. Worth pointing out that in the summer of 2020, we could say with a high degree of confidence that the yield on government bonds generally was at a 5,000-year low. We have interest rates going back to the Sumerian period, which is 3,000 BC. So to take a bet that interest rates at a 5,000-year low will go lower was also something that was quite brave. But as you mentioned in the introduction, lots of wealth managers also took a similar view that a 5,000-year low for interest rates could actually be continue to go even lower. So there's just all these things combined. But it's certainly, as I said in the summary of the ceremony, there were lots of mistakes. But the biggest one was not to read any financial history, to realize that bonds have yields and prices and the interest rates go up and down. And when you're at a 5,000-year low, there is a relatively good prospect that the next move is going to be up.
Well put. So here was the thing that I learned from that because I remember, you know, as trying to get information without really digging into the weeds is a little difficult. So you get these things about, it was a social media run that somehow the word spread and everybody started pulling money out. In fact, my wife even sent me a tweet from somebody, some guy who had money there, who was talking about how he literally couldn't get his money out. But then I realized, and I want to just confirm this is the right understanding of this, it wasn't like your typical retail base that's going to go into some big bank to go cash their check and whatever. You had a concentration amongst a lot of the same type of people with a lot of uninsured money in a kind of located in a general demographic or geographic area who all started communicating together. I mean, it's literally a small, powerful group of people with a lot of money that created this panic, which, I mean, is that the right understanding?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I can't say to you that we've never had a bank like this before, but we certainly haven't had many banks like this before where such a high proportion of deposits uninsured. And it's an elite group who all know each other and communicate with each other. Remember also that that elite group is paid to get good investment returns. If I was one of them, the most embarrassing thing that could possibly happen to me is that I could lose money on deposits. I mean, there'd be nothing more detrimental to the future of my career that this guy couldn't even invest in a bank deposit and make me. So you could see why when the time came, it's like pass the parcel. It's the end of your career if you happen to be stuck in that bank and the deposits of that bank as the FDIC has to suspend or close it. So it was the word unique is overused. I think it probably was unique in terms of the concentration, a lack of insurance. And we have to stress that, you know, had everybody been insured, I'm not sure if, I mean, SVB may still be with us. Had all their deposits been insured, that was quite a large loss. But the loss in itself may not have finished off the bank if its depositors had hung around. The people focus on the ease of communication as a reason why that happened. And that's obviously true. We can all communicate more easily. We all have apps where we can press a button and move the money. But I think more important was the lack of insurance and this very narrow, confined 16th biggest bank in America, but still a very limited number of depositors who all kind of knew each other.
Last thing on this, and then I'll kind of get to the final conclusion. What was the significance? And this is really just for people that, again, hear this stuff, but don't really understand you, because you mentioned the day-to-day valuation. Where does the value of those bonds that they own going down? I mean, can you explain that component of it? People, deposits going and the bank being forced to sell, maybe elaborate on that a little bit.
So people should just think of a bank's balance sheet, maybe the way they think of their own. You have assets and you have liabilities. For most of us, that would be our mortgage and that would be our home. when you find yourself in a situation where your liabilities are worth more than your assets, then we say it's negative equity. Now, the problem for any listed institution, but particularly a bank, is that that is all declared to the stock market on a quarterly basis. And if your asset price is falling pretty dramatically and the equity, that gap, I call it the fine sliver of hope between assets and liabilities. If the value of your assets is falling and the value of your liabilities, primarily deposits, isn't, then people are going to look and say, this guy's capital is shrinking rapidly and maybe one day won't have any capital. And a bank without capital is a bank where there is a risk that your deposits could be frozen, or if you're not insured, you could actually lose deposits. So the problem for FDIC is that everybody could see really every day how much money they were losing on government bonds. And the government bond portfolio would be disclosed every quarter, and then all the analysts could look at the price of government bonds and they could see quite quickly that perhaps this gap between assets and liabilities, this equity was declining and declining. And then unlike your mortgage, which you have locked in for 30 years, the depositors can pull the money overnight. The companies can pull the money instantly. So that's the difference between your own personal situation and the situation for a bank today. Most people, I think particularly in the US, have the 30-year mortgage, but the banks are borrowing overnight. And if you lose the confidence of the people who lend money to you overnight, there's very little that's going to save you in a situation like that, which is why the deposit insurance is so important and why it's changed the nature of banking since it was first introduced in the Great Depression. It was introduced in the Great Depression to try and stop this damaging situation. But as I said, the problem with Silicon Valley Bank is they managed to source their deposits almost exclusively from people who didn't get the benefit of that insurance.
I actually remember I was working as a manager at a savings and loan in late 80s, early 90s, when that whole industry collapsed. We had this thing called the Resolution Trust Corporation, because the FSLIC, which was the FDIC of the savings loan industry, had gone bankrupt. But they came out, and I remember we were trained at the time on how to insure a family of four. This was back when I think the limit was like $100,000 per account. But you could structure the accounts to insure like $1.4 million just by trust, joint, the whole thing. And you could do all these different things. And yeah, so to think that it isn't hard to extend that insurance out, depending upon how these accounts are set up. So to think that people weren't covered in those kind of amounts is a little absurd.
Well, as a family, you can probably do it. But remember, these are venture capitalists.
Right.
They receive tens of millions, and we're going to say even billions in cash, and then they can receive it up front and invest it very slowly. So now maybe they should have been in treasury bills, which would have been a lot safer.
I was just going to say,
different business to be in. They were found themselves with lots of cash. It's worth saying, of course, as well, that the whole point of this was to invest the money. So naturally, if you were running a big bank like that, you might have expected your deposits to go down as it was invested. So that's why it was different. And most bankers wouldn't accept that concentration risk. They'd try to have the branch network. They'd try to have the mom and pops. They'd try to have the insured deposits. And then all bankers have something on top of that, usually corporations, venture capitalists. But these guys were heavily concentrated on the one source of funding. So that exercise which you mentioned, yeah, you can do that with maybe $1 million, maybe a wee bit more than $1 million. But these guys had tens and hundreds of millions of dollars to put out there in the banks, and they all decided to go to the same bank.
You also mentioned something too, and then I want to get to the final question here, but which I hadn't heard, that it was the second largest failure, bank failure in the U.S. to Washington Mutual during the great financial crisis. So anyway, significant. So here's the thing. I remember at the end, and I don't know, maybe I'm asking for something that isn't really a question that can be answered, but you talked about the lessons learned. I'm asking the lessons learned from all this, and maybe even extends into this whole endeavor with the library and all the research that you've done, both as an analyst and in building out this library. But the horseshoe nail, there's one lesson, I mean, that just comes to mind. I know there's a bunch. I mean, we've talked a whole lot of things. But is there one thing that just seems to just continually repeat itself to you?
I think the core of all of this, and I'll quote from the late, great Charlie Munger, is never, ever think about anything when you should be thinking about incentives. And most of these failures happen because the person allocating the capital effectively had an incentive to do it the way they did it. Now, I think one of the benefits of us reading and studying and understanding financial history is that we may be able to create better incentives. And I'm not talking about the government. I'm not talking about regulation. I'm talking about boards having better incentives. So there, as you say, there are a myriad of these things. But ultimately, most of them come down to the fact that people do stupid things because they're incentivized to do stupid things and they're paid to do stupid things. And a lot of that is about the time horizon. If you and I are really playing towards the annual bonus, we can hope to get away with things up until Christmas because we'll get that bonus and it may not be clawed back after Christmas. So when people do ask me, you know, what's the one thing we could do to try and make this better? it is changing the incentive structure. And we can run through lots of different ways you can do that, but at least extend the time horizon for the incentive structure. Don't reward people on a 12-month basis, because you're paying them really to take very high risks over the short term. And over the long term, they can't do that because they're much more likely to get caught out. I mean, all these mistakes were made with people using other people's money. Okay, so a lot of them had their own equity in this, but fundamentally, it was other people's money. To have the wrong incentive structure in place for people managing other people's money, whether in an operating company or an investment company, is the mistake. And over the years now, we've put in place these wrong incentives and we need to change them.
Dag, we could spend another hour talking about that, because you mentioned a number of these things in your book, The Asian Financial Crisis. I remember benchmarking and the system itself. I mean, again, that's a whole other subject. It's structured in a way to create these kinds of conflicts of interest.
I always think, because I live in Edinburgh and Adam Smith used to live here, the famous Adam Smith, the father of economics. And if I sat him down, if he was sitting beside me in this desk and I explained to him the way we run this thing that we call capitalism and the incentive structures we have in it, he wouldn't recognize it at all. It's just not the thing that he thought capitalism was, because of the bad incentive structures and the targets and the indexing. I mean, indexing, what on earth is indexing, where the company with the biggest market capitalization receives a higher cost of capital or a lower cost of capital and more capital at a lower cost when it demands it? I mean, that's not what Adam Smith wrote about in The Wealth of Nations. So that's the problem. We call it one thing, but it's become distorted over the years. Frankly, I think it's become gamed over the years by managerial capitalism, which is another big story we could go into. It's run for the benefit of the agents and not the principals, another story we could go into. So you can get up, I think, and you can be very critical of the system without saying, I'm very critical of capitalism. What you're actually saying is, this isn't capitalism. Capitalism without competition is what? I don't know what it is, but increasingly, in many industries as well, we've actually got no competition. Smith was very, very against that. So there's so many things wrong with it that I think could make it better. And as long as there are things wrong with it, we'll be having an annual Library of Mistakes Awards ceremony, I think, and I have no great hope that I stand up one year under a big banner saying mission accomplished. Yeah. I think we'll be there for some time to come.
Oh, that's perfect. Russell, listen, I want you to know, I know you're a busy person and I just appreciate you making time. And I got to tell you, we're a small little firm. We manage $200 million. We have a nice, manageable group of clients we work with that are good people. And I think what gives us an advantage is the fact that I've got resources like you, certainly the library database, but particularly the Solid Ground newsletters, the quarterly report, these phone calls. I mean, it's refreshing to get information that's coming from a completely different place that somewhere along the line or another isn't connected to a product that's actually connected to a historical view. And there's really value in that for us. And so I know I've told you that before and I email you from time to time, but I just want you to know I appreciate it. And it makes us, I feel like I said, we have a bit of a competitive advantage in that regard.
Hopefully I can say to you is that what financial history helps us do is to ask the right questions. This may not seem like a big issue, but in my opinion, most of Wall Street is getting all the right answers to all the wrong questions. So just asking the right questions is a good thing. And then you don't even have to get the right answer. You just have to get a slightly better answer than everybody else. So I don't think this is rocket science. I'm not qualified to be at rocket science. I'm not that smart. But I can at least look back at the past to try and work out what the right questions are. And I think if we keep our focus on the right questions, we've got a reasonable chance of getting slightly better answers and better outcomes for all our clients.
No, that's perfect. Well, I always like to end on a rising note of hope. So I'll say thank you so much for your time today, Russell. And it's good to see you again.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Emerson Fersh is a registered representative with and securities offered through LPL Financial. Member FINRA, SIPC. Advisor services offered through LPL Financial, a registered investment advisor and separate entity from Capital Investment Advisors. The opinions voiced in this podcast are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriate qualified professional prior to making a decision. The guest speakers and the companies they represent are not affiliated with or endorsed by LPL Financial or Capital Investment Advisors. Individual tax and legal matters should be discussed with your tax or legal expert. Economic forecasts set forth may not develop as predicted, and there can be no guarantee that strategies promoted will be successful. All performance referenced is historical and is no guarantee of future results. All indices are unmanaged. and may not be invested into directly. There is no assurance that the techniques and strategies discussed are suitable for all investors or will yield positive outcomes. The purchase of certain securities may be required to affect some of the strategies. Investing involves risks, including possible loss of principal.